Welcome to the Animal Welfare Junction. This is your host, Dr. G, and our music is written and produced by Mike Sullivan. Today, we are going to be discussing the importance of the human-animal bond, something very, very important for everybody that cares about animals. And we have an amazing guest. Our guest is Courtney Wennerstrom. Welcome, Courtney, to the Animal Welfare Junction.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
You have a podcast of your own called The Pedestal on the Human-Animal Bond, and I can't wait to hear about that. But first, how about you tell our listeners about you, about your journey from the beginning to what brought you here?
Okay, sure. So my background is a little bit diverse and winding, I guess. So I'm a former visiting lecturer in English at Indiana University. I taught composition and literature at all levels of the university, from freshman, incoming freshman composition to junior and senior level literature classes. And I have a background in 18th century lit. So I worked in the period between about 1740 and 1820. So you can think of Jane Austen as being sort of at the kind of cusp of the end of that period. And I absolutely loved it. I loved teaching, I loved writing, I loved doing my research. But it became really, really difficult to oh my gosh, my dog is drinking water. I'm sorry. Speaking of the human-animal bond. I loved what I was doing, but it became pretty difficult to make a living in academia because they no longer really want to pay professors. The idea of a tenure track job is kind of, we're completely losing that. And so instead, what universities do is they pay you by the class, and there's no benefits and there's no guarantee that you'll have your job the semester that's coming. And so it's kind of just, it's stressful. And I was forced to leave the profession for that reason. But I was very, very lucky because I had a secondary passion, which is animal welfare. And I was sort of always doing that on the side as like, that was like my naughty side project when I was supposed to be working on my dissertation. I co-founded the first successful animal welfare organization on the Indiana University campus with some colleagues and friends of mine. So I'd already sort of set myself up for that path when I finally decided to leave academia. And so I transitioned to animal welfare in about 2017, and I worked for a long time in Ed Michelson Found Animals, which has a free national microchip registry. It's a nonprofit. I worked for Pets for Life, which, as you know, offers free spay neuter and veterinary services to communities, underserved communities. And I now am a freelance writer, a blogger, and a podcaster who really wants to try to make a difference for pets and the people who love them.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm very familiar with the Pets for Life. I work with HSUS on different programs, and I think that the whole idea of their program is amazing because it's about affordable and accessible care, which is a lot of what we do to individuals to be able to keep animals with their owners. What is the importance of efforts to keep people and animals together?
It's such a good question, and I think it's such a complicated and simple question at the same time. I'm sure your listeners who are familiar with your show already have a sense of this, but just to make sure that anyone listening for the first time is aware, right now animal welfare is in kind of an unprecedented crisis where in 2020, adoptions went up, euthanasia in shelters went down, and it was kind of like we could all take a deep breath for a hot minute. But now pet parents are surrendering their dogs and cats and other animals at an alarming rate, and they are, and euthanasia in shelters for space is really in a crisis. So the problem is, and there's a lot of, you know, everyone wants to blame different things. The shelters, obviously, they are overcrowded. They are often municipal shelters are often underfunded and understaffed and under-resourced. And then there's animals pouring in with no way, you know, no real way to get them out. And so animal advocates are watching as dogs and cats and other pets die by the thousands every day across the country. So we are really in a crisis. And the question of how to prevent it is I think it's a larger social issue that is going to require us to not only rethink a lot of policies and procedures that we have, not only in shelters, but also we've really got to have a massive cultural shift in understanding the importance of the human-animal bond, recognizing it and supporting it across every aspect of society. And we can kind of talk about what that means, but it's gonna take all of us to really fix this crisis. So it's complicated on the one hand. On the other hand, it's really simple. Spay and neuter your pets, adopt pets and don't buy them, and don't relinquish them to shelters. You know, on the one hand, it's like that, it's that simple. But I think people don't understand that only about 20% of people are adopting their pets. And there are shelters in the United States where 80% of the animals are euthanized. So you can see right there that if people would adopt, we would be in a much better place. I'm gonna stop and pause there to see if you have any questions, and then we can kind of, I think, get into all the ways in which we might try to systemically fix it.
Yeah, because some of the groups that we work with, for instance, they will get phone calls of people wanting to surrender animals, and they are at capacity. But instead of saying, okay, we'll try to figure out a way for you to surrender the animal, they evaluate more the reasons why the person needs to surrender the animal. Because a large number of individuals that need to part ways with their pets are for reasons that can be assessed and assisted. A group that we work with locally, Ross County Humane Society, she got a call about somebody that needed to get rid of his dog because it was heartworm positive and they could not afford to take care of the animal. And when they went in to surrender it, they understood the owner was crying. The owner was upset. He did not want to part with this dog, but he was doing it because he felt that it was the best thing for the dog. So what the rescue did was they found a resource to help pay for the heartworm for that dog so that the dog could stay in that home. So it solved the problem from so many different perspectives, right? So it helped this owner maintain their dog. It was one less dog that the shelter had to deal with, or potentially one less dog that the shelter had to euthanize, because we have to think about the fact that the rescues and the shelters don't want to euthanize these animals. They're not happy to do it. It's something that they have to do, and it's such a huge burden to them. So by helping people keep their animals, it also helps with the compassion fatigue of the shelter staff.
You make such a smart point, because it's a win. When we can keep pets and people together, it's a win-win-win for everyone. Society really benefits when people and pets are able to overcome obstacles like that. And one of the things that I think people don't understand is we don't set pet parents up for success. You're absolutely right. People will adopt or buy a dog or a cat. And then what? We just say good luck, send them on their way. So in order to have, I think, a society that recognizes the importance of the human-animal bond and does everything it can to support it, we need massive systemic change. So one thing that you're pointing out is that, yes, people surrender their pets for minor but often costly veterinary issues. One of the things that I saw the most when I worked at Pets for Life and in shelters is a real problem with even something like dental care, right? Dental care is prohibitively expensive for a lot of people. So you'd see people with like 12-year-old chihuahuas who they absolutely adored, surrendering them to the shelter tearfully, hoping that maybe that dog would get some relief. And that's just unfair to everyone. So what animal welfare is trying to do is to switch from an adoption-based model, which is basically the model where you just try to adopt dogs out one after the other as fast as you can. That doesn't work. We're trying to switch to a community-based model where the idea is, instead of investing in more buildings and more housing for shelters, which are not good places for pets or people to be anyway, instead thinking of a shelter as a community resource center where people can come in and get help with veterinary care. They can get help with behavioral issues. They can get help with whatever it is they need help with to help them keep their pets. It's a really big shift that we've had over the past few years in animal welfare, and it's an important one. The other thing is we really need landlords and especially insurance companies to kind of rethink their outdated policies about arbitrary breed and weight restrictions and things like that. As you know, right now, one of the challenges is people are often forced to relinquish their pets simply because they can't find pet-friendly housing, or it's prohibitively expensive. So, you know, there's this concept of like people will say, "Oh, I'd never surrender my pet. I'd live on the street." You really can't tell that to a single parent who is about to be homeless that they're going to live on the street. That's not reasonable. And the problem is, insurance companies have these really arbitrary, again, breed and weight restrictions. So, you know, you can have a pet, you can have a dog under 50 pounds, but at 51 pounds, apparently that dog becomes destructive, right? That's not true. And more research is showing the benefits of pet-friendly housing to the community, because pet-friendly communities in general are, they have lower crime rates. So, so the thing is, people really can't find housing for their animals. And that is one of the worst situations for the human animal bond that there is right now. And if we could convince insurance companies, and again, the research supports it, that pet parents are actually like scientifically better renters. They take better care of their homes. They're just, again, pet friendly communities have all kinds of benefits. And we need to start understanding that, because without understanding that, we keep separating people from their pets, and the crisis gets worse, and everyone loses.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually faced something like this personally because I was looking for an apartment and I had a Great Dane and an English Bulldog mix. And the apartment people said, well, the Great Dane is too big and we're concerned about the size and the danger to the community. But the English Bulldog is okay. Well, little do they know, the Great Dane was a couch potato. That all she wanted to do was just lay down and then go outside for a couple of minutes to use the bathroom and then come back in. Whereas the English Bulldog ate walls, right? So the dog that they were willing to accept as in the house would have destroyed the whole apartment, as opposed to the Great Dane that would literally just do nothing. So there is a disconnect into the ability of people that have no real knowledge of what a specific dog breed size represents. They're just basing it on biases that are not necessarily correct. And I know that people that have children, like the children are sometimes more destructive to an apartment or to a household, right? As opposed to the animals that live in it.
So you're absolutely right. And these restrictions mean nothing, and they're based on these terrible biases about breeds, right? A lot of them are just, a lot of apartment complexes are like, no huskies, no German shepherds, no pit bulls. And those can be some of the best dogs that ever existed. And there's absolutely no science to support that breed-specific legislation in general ever has done anything to protect communities. For anyone listening who doesn't know, breed-specific legislation in general refers to when certain breeds are banned from even being allowed to exist. For instance, I live in Denver, and for a very, very, very long time, we had an outright pit bull ban. No one was allowed to own or have a pit bull, and if a pit bull ended up in a shelter, they were basically immediately euthanized. They have amended this to be slightly better, although it's still a bit problematic. But there is so much literature and so many studies done that showed that that did not prevent any bites from happening in Denver. It didn't really protect the community at all, and all it did was destroy families and kill perfectly lovely dogs. So insurance companies really need to catch up with this. They really need to understand that by allowing people to have their dogs and their precious babies, they're probably going to have better tenants and better results than if they don't. And so we have it all backwards, basically. We have to turn it around.
Another thing that I think, we're talking about the issues that are presented by the housing and the communities, but then we need to look at the issues that are created by people that don't do proper research, right? Because I think that getting a pet is kind of like dating. So you have certain needs, some, right? You have a personality, you have things that you like to do, but people get stuck on a look and it's like, oh, that guy is really hot. And then we think of, oh, that dog is beautiful. That's the dog that I want. So like you said, huskies. So many people are like, oh my God, huskies are so beautiful. And then they get this dog and it doesn't match their personality. They don't match what they want to do. You have somebody that wants to get a dog to go hiking, but then they get a dog that's a couch potato. Or you get somebody that just wants to sit and watch TV all day, and they go out and get, you know, like a terrier, a heeler, or something like that. So we have to be better selective and not just select with our eyes, but we have to look further into it. So what would you have to say about that, about setting yourself up for success and setting your animal up for success, so we don't have unrealistic expectations about the animals that we bring into our lives?
Ooh, it's so good. I love your analogy about dating the hot person and not really, you know, understanding who they are on the inside. This is happening. You bring up such a good point, because this is literally happening all over the country. And in particular, so again, I work with rescues, most specifically in California, and with shelters, and they are overflowing in particular with pit bulls, huskies, and German shepherds. And those three breeds are being euthanized in mass by the thousands every single day. Their curse is that they're beautiful. And they're also working dogs, and they are, especially shepherds and huskies, right? And other cattle dogs, they are working dogs, and they need a purpose, and they need a job, and they are highly energetic. They shed, they talk all day. I know, cause I'm a husky mom. My two huskies are rescued, or I should say they rescued me, but I've had huskies my whole life, and I love them so much, and I get them on a fundamental level, and I understand what they need, but they are so beautiful, and people just get them and then are miffed by their energy level. They're miffed by the fact that they shed, all the things that huskies they don't like the husky they buy. And then they don't do any research, and they don't train or work with their animal at all. And then they just dump them at a shelter. And it is it's a real tragedy for everyone involved, because that family, if they had done a little bit more work, could have found a dog that fit their lifestyle a little bit better. So yes, I think people really need to think about, what kind of a dog do I want? Let me do some research. And maybe stop thinking that you want a specific breed of dog, right? Because again, that's focused on the external, and really start thinking about what kind of characteristics or qualities you want your dog to have. There's a really great resource called How I Met My Dog. And I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but you can go and take, like, it was a 60, I think it's like a 64 point questionnaire, psychology questionnaire that was designed by psychologists to find out exactly what kind of dog you want. And I hope they do something like that for cats too. But the idea is, talk to your friends who have a breed that you think you want. First of all, maybe don't think so much, don't be so breed fixated, but talk to friends who have dogs and see what it takes to keep them happy and healthy. Because I'm gonna tell you right now, if you do not want to walk 6 miles a day or take your husky to a dog park, to run for a good hour, you don't want a husky. Like, you just don't.
Right.
They're going to need a lot. You know, you've got to be willing to work with them, and they need, even that isn't always enough. My dogs need a lot of enrichment. They need a lot of things. And I find it very pleasurable to give that to them. But I understand that they're a lot for some people, that the problem is they're being punished for the total inability for people to have any foresight. Don't get a dog on a whim. Don't get a dog as a present for someone. You know, I'm getting a family member, and I better make sure this is a good fit, kind of like you said with a marriage. You know, you're not just gonna go and grab the first attractive person you see and hope for the best. That's just not how this works.
Yeah, because what we see is that people are punishing animals for doing what is natural to them, right? So the dog is too hyper, so then we're going to go out and electrocute them daily because we need them to not be hyper. Well, what are we doing? We are eliminating trust. We're eliminating respect. We're eliminating humane treatment because we're punishing them for doing what's natural. It would be like if we have a need to have a conversation with somebody because we've had a long day, and then somebody zaps us about it or beats us because it's not your time to talk, right? They're just trying to communicate. They're just trying to do what they normally do. So these unrealistic expectations, I think, lead animals for failure. And a lot of people don't realize these problems until it's too late, right? Because at 3 months old, the puppy chewing on things, it's funny, but they don't understand that not dealing with that behavior back then at 6 months, 9 months, a year, it becomes a problem. And now it's a learned problem. And now what are we going to do about it? And then you try to find a home for a dog that, what are you going to do? Advertise, looking for a home for my dog that chews blinds. Like, you know, who's going to help with that?
Right. And you're right that we punish them for just very, very natural behaviors. And people think of training. I think one way to reframe this for everyone is like, so training sounds like work, right? Training sounds really hard. Training sounds overwhelming and annoying. Really, training at its best is just learning what your dog loves and needs, learning how to communicate with them and teaching them what your expectations are. It's actually just fun bonding time with your dog. It shouldn't be overwhelming and it shouldn't be something you see as work. It's really just something that is supposed to be really, really fun and enjoyable for both of you. So when you get a pet, you know, and cats too, they need a lot. They need a lot. And people have assumptions about cats that they'll take care of themselves, when in reality, especially indoor cats, they need enrichment so they can express species specific behaviors like chasing and pouncing and, you know, they need mental stimulation as well. So a lot of times people think my cat, or will say like, my cat or my dog is destructive. My cat or my dog is XYZ. When really the truth is they're just not getting something that they desperately need, right? They're not bad. No animals are inherently bad. You know, they're just not, yeah. They're not malicious. People often, especially with cats, have this notion that their cat is conniving or something, or trying to, you know, or is acting out. And it's just not true. Like, animals are awesome and they're so sweet and they're so pure. And all they want to do is love you and then do the things they need to do to be happy and healthy.
I have two cats, right? And they're the first cats that I have owned that have not been declawed. Now, the last cat that I had that was declawed was more than 10 years ago, because there was this notion of, you get a cat, you get it declawed, because if not, they're going to tear up your house. So I didn't know any better. So I've evolved in my knowledge and understanding of cats and behavior. So these guys are not declawed. And I can say that they do not destroy my house. And I'm not great at keeping their nails trimmed. But as you can see in the back, like, I have cat trees and I have different surfaces for them to scratch and different places for them to do the things that they need to do so that they don't find a need to do it on my couch, on my carpet, on that kind of stuff. One of the reasons I slowly stopped doing declaws for the animals that we were seeing at our practice, because there was this whole idea of, well, if we don't declaw these cats, then people are not going to come in and get them spayed or neutered because, you know, they want to get them declawed. And I learned that it was about education, right? So we started educating owners about the importance of the claws to them in their normal behavioral expression, and then the pain and discomfort that they suffer through life, and how that pain and discomfort then lead to negative behaviors. So cats that urinate outside of the box, they're not doing it because they're angry. They're doing it because they're in pain. They have anxiety, they have problems. So that is their way of dealing with it. Cats rarely go outside of the litter box just because they're pissed at you. They go outside of the litter box because there is an issue or something like that.
Yes, yes. Oh, thank God. You know, it's great that I'm so glad you brought this up. A lot of quote unquote behavioral issues are medical. You don't realize that, especially with cats urinating outside of the box, they can have Pandora syndrome, right? So even if they don't have a UTI, they might have a Pandora syndrome, which of course is like a psychosomatic set of symptoms that come from being understimulated. So like, being a bored indoor house cat can actually make you sick. Mm-hmm. People don't understand that. And so yes, there are these correlations that people don't always make between health and behavior. So that's another thing, right? And again, it's just really an animal either who is sick or not getting the very important, their absolutely fundamental needs met, just like we would act out if we weren't getting ours, right?
Right. And sometimes we don't meet those needs literally out of just we don't want to be bothered, right? So with cats, for instance, we always tell people have one box more than the number of cats that you have. So I have two cats, I have four boxes. I have three boxes with crystal litter and I have one box with clay litter because I figured that that was a combination of things that they wanted. I have boxes in my main floor. I have a box in my bedroom because I want to eliminate them from finding a need to go to the bathroom on my bed. So I put a box somewhere in my bedroom that's not a nuisance, that's not a problem, but it's still accessible to them. So we hear about people that say, oh yeah, well, I have three boxes and they're all in the basement. Well, think about if you have a two floors in your house and a basement, and all of a sudden you really, really have to go to the bathroom and you're all the way upstairs, are you going to make it to the basement? So sometimes these animals are having accidents or doing things just because we are not helping them with making things accessible for them. Like we're not setting them up for success.
That's absolutely true. And it's heartbreaking because they don't really need that. I mean, when you think about it, they don't ask for that much compared to what they give back. You know, like that's not that hard. You know, put a litter box in your bedroom is not that hard. Versus taking your cat to a shelter where they are likely to be euthanized.
So another thing that I wanted to talk about is, you know, the importance of the human-animal bond in the veterinary environment. So when in the facility that I worked at and the clinics that we do right now, everybody is really happy with what we do, right? Because they're able to afford the care for their pet. We are accessible. So they're really happy with us. They're happy with our staff. And then our staff feeds off on that happiness from the client. So how can the human-animal bond assist with combating compassion fatigue of veterinary staff members?
Oh, I think it's such a good question. First, just any veterinarian listening, thank you, thank you, thank you for your work. I know that veterinarians have a high rate of suicide. It's a very, very tough job. And I think because veterinary care is often prohibitively or just very expensive, people assume that veterinarians are just out there making tons of money and driving Porsches and luxury vehicles. And in reality, it costs a lot of money to run a vet clinic. It's very expensive. And veterinarians are about to be, as you know better than anyone, in very short supply. They're dropping out of the profession. They're not entering the profession. And so for anybody listening, first, please be kind to your veterinarians. They're doing a really hard job and we need them. Like, we desperately need them. Personally, I wish I could be a veterinarian, but I can't deal with that, all the things that come along with it. So I really admire veterinarians. The second thing that comes to mind is, you know, it's great when you have a human who's attached to an animal who can tell their story for them. I think it must be very hard for shelter veterinarians who are assessing an animal who's just come in and they have absolutely no idea what's going on with them, emotionally, psychologically, physically. Like, they don't know and they have to assess from scratch. So, you know, I think obviously it's great when you have somebody who can help tell their story, right? That's really important.
When a pet owner is bringing an animal to the vet, especially when the pet is sick, and then even if they're coming in just to get general wellness care, that person has anxiety, right? It doesn't matter how much they like or don't like their vet, they're going to have anxiety for a couple of different reasons. They're going to have anxiety because they're about to spend a lot of money. They have no idea how much, but they figure there's going to be a lot of money involved. And then there's anxiety because they know that they're taking their pet that they care and love to somewhere that they're afraid of. Because even if everybody's really nice, there's going to be an injection, there's going to be a shot or something. It's kind of like taking your kid to the pediatrician. You know, your kid knows that it's going to the pediatrician and is stressing out because there may be a vaccine coming up. And the pet owner has those same concerns. So when a person brings their pet to a veterinary facility, they care about the medical care that the patient receives. But more so, they're stuck on the care that they are receiving both as a whole from an emotional and empathy standpoint. We may have just done a surgery that saved that animal's life, but the review is stuck on the care that they received, right? Did they care about me? Did they care about my pet? And we as staff, like veterinary staff, get upset or get pissed because we just spend all this time and energy and we saved your pet and you don't care about that. You just care that somebody was not nice to you. We, as veterinarians and technicians and assistants and receptionists, we need to understand that not caring about people is not a thing, right? So the animals don't bring themselves. We have to care about the animal and we have to care about the person that is attached to that animal. The human-animal bond at that point is important in helping the patient, but then also taking care of the human-animal bond can help the veterinary team with compassion fatigue. Because again, if we are getting stressed out by negative responses, by complaints, by the owner, if we are showing compassion to those animals, the owner is happy, that reflects on our staff, and then that decreases compassion fatigue.
Sure, that makes sense. I mean, it's a whole cycle where pet parents need to be kinder to veterinarians and veterinarians need to be empathetic. I know it must be a really difficult balance. I mean, they talk about, you know, there's this idea that in order to do these sorts of jobs where you have to deal with animals in potentially excruciating pain or end of life decisions or all of the things that you have to deal with, to some extent, you need to have, you know, a clinical detachment so you can do your job, right? You can't feel the way the pet parent feels, or you're not able to get anywhere. You have to maintain a level of professionalism. At the same time, empathy is so important because these are our babies, right? And I recently lost my cat, Leche. He was my heart and soul cat. I loved him. He was my first cat. And he was diagnosed with bone cancer. And my vet, Dr. Ryan, was so kind when I found out. I thought I was just taking him in for, he had some things going on in his mouth. And I just thought he was going to need a dental. Instead, I got a terminal diagnosis and my husband wasn't there. And my vet, Dr. Ryan, gave me the biggest hug. And, you know, that really meant everything to me because I was just trying to process that I was about to lose my baby. I know it really made, I kind of choke up talking about it, but it really made a difference in how I was able to kind of compose myself to drive home. You know, like I had to drive home with Leche and I was by myself. And Dr. Ryan is a real person with a heart and a soul. And he really made a difference in my life at that moment. In one of the hardest things that I've ever had to do, he showed up for me professionally and personally. And I love him for it. Like, he will always have a very special place in my heart because he knew how awful this was. And he didn't forsake me in that moment.
Right. And I feel that, you know, that is really important in recognizing, you know, that pets are family, right? It's like a child. So understanding the importance of the bond between the pet and the pet owner or caretaker, and then taking that into consideration in how we approach and the recommendations that we make, because we need to make recommendations that are going to be well received and that are going to be feasible or possible to the owner. We don't want to set anybody up for failure from a medical side, right? Because with different problems, like for instance, with pets with cancer, you may have somebody that wants to pursue additional treatment, additional surgery, chemotherapy, all sorts of stuff. And then that is okay. But you may have somebody that doesn't want to put their pet through that and doesn't want to put their pet through suffering. And you have to understand and respect that as well. So understanding where people are coming from and then making the recommendations that are acceptable to them within their means.
Yeah, that must be hard, you know, watching people who are trying to make end of life decisions and how excruciating that is. I mean, it's absolutely one of the worst things that humans go through. Or even just, you know, again, making these really horrible, tough calls about, will I spend $10,000 on my pet or not? You know, and if I don't have it, will I borrow it? How will I get it? I mean, it's one thing when you're coming in for routine care, it's another when their pet is in crisis. So I know the more empathy a vet can have, the better, because yeah, we're a package. Right. We're a package deal. And people really want to feel seen and heard and understood about their animals. And veterinarians are probably going to need to be a little bit, you know, counselors and therapists too, right? It's a lot to ask of a person, but you are right that that's what we need as pet parents. We do need somebody to tell us it's okay, and to tell us, you know, that we're doing the right thing if we are unsure, and all of those things that will really benefit everybody in the situation.
What one person can do or is willing to do or wants to do is very different. It's very personal, right? So we have to understand everything before we can make a proper recommendation or an educated recommendation. And then we have to be comforting to the individual so that they feel good about their decision, even if it's euthanizing a pet, because it is a very difficult decision. And I've always told my clients that we don't do it for us, we do it for them, right? Because we don't want to put them down. We don't want to part ways with them. So we are doing it not because we're selfish. It's somewhat the most selfless thing that we can do at times. So it's understanding the importance of that bond. And then again, that comes back to the staff and feeling good about the services that we are providing.
And hopefully trusting that people know their pets and are doing what's the best for them. I know sometimes people are caught up in their own pain and they don't want to make decisions that they need to make. But a lot of, you know, like for instance, I've had to make end of life decisions for four animals now that I've lost, who have all died in my arms. And I was lucky that I was able to be there for them. But, you know, I made different decisions for each of them based on their personalities and their, you know, like what I thought they would want. Right. They are all very different. And so for some pets, my dog Maddie got bone cancer. Also, I've lost two animals to bone cancer. And I thought, you know what? There was an option to amputate her front leg and then do chemo, and it would have bought her only 9 months. And I thought, you know, Maddie hates vets and she doesn't like being messed with. And so no, for her, I don't see that would be a very good option. My dog Kodiak probably would have wanted to fight. So I think trusting that people do know and love and understand their pets is probably helpful. Although I'm sure you see cases where that's, you know, where you're concerned that that's not true. So I can't imagine how hard it is to do what you do.
You know, it's about not being judgmental. And there are a lot of different factors that go into it. For example, somebody may bring in a pet that is diabetic, and it is something that can be managed with injections, but the owner may not be able or willing to give injections. So at that point, what is the worst thing that can happen, right? They can suffer the consequences of being diabetic. So we have to work within those means. Does it make them horrible people because they cannot provide the medical care? No, not necessarily. Again, we cannot be judgmental. They may have their reasons for why they cannot provide that care. And therefore, humane euthanasia may be what's best for that cat. Whereas somebody else may say, yeah, we have the time, we have the energy, we have the money, we have everything to provide a good care. So we have to provide treatment that is not judgmental. And by not being judgmental, we can also get a more sincere information from the owners about what they can do. We don't want to guilt somebody into agreeing to do a treatment or at-home care that they know they cannot do, but they feel that if they tell you they cannot do it, you're going to look down on them. So then they take the pet home to suffer. We have to understand that we are here to present all the possible options, but then it's ultimately up to the owner to let us know what they can and cannot do.
Absolutely. And I know those are really hard decisions for people.
Switching back to the human-animal bond, the first episode that we did on the Animal Welfare Junction was on the importance of affordable and accessible animal care. And the question that we asked all our guests is, what are your thoughts on the, if you cannot afford an animal, don't have it? So I want to ask that from you. What are your thoughts? If you cannot afford the vet, don't get the pet.
I never heard it phrased that way. I like, that's funny, but obviously it's not a funny topic. Well, I'm really passionate about this because that assumption that if you can't afford an animal, you shouldn't get one is really elitist. And also people don't understand that It helps nobody because there are animals who are dying in shelters who need families, and there are families who need animals. And animals are not luxury items, right? It's not like you can tighten your belt and go without a pet. So for people who want and need pets, it's extremely important that we support them and make veterinary care and other things accessible, because again, they are not luxury items and pets need families. So the way that we would win socially and the way that we could make things better is by, again, these sort of massive systemic changes where we understand that animals are vital members of the family. And when families are in crisis, for whatever reason, we need to realize that the pets need to be considered. So if someone is fleeing domestic violence, we need their pets need to be able to come with them. If they're in financial hardship and they're in crisis, they need to be able to, whatever social services they're getting, need to include pets. If they're, you know, disaster preparedness, if they're fleeing disaster, then we need to have plans for pets. And that's, you know, something that we really started to look at with Katrina. And again, housing needs to be pet friendly. We really need to start understanding that society is better off when we support the human-animal bond at every level. And money should not be the object that it is for pet parents, right? It's just, it's not serving us. There's tons and tons and tons of research that shows just how important pets are for our emotional and physical well-being. And even human health insurance companies should start to understand that they need to support people in having pets. You know, they need to be seen as dependents, the dependents they are. Socially, they need to be included literally across every aspect of society. And I promise everybody, it will be a win-win.
I saw a research recently that evaluated the costs of healthcare for humans compared of people owning pets and people not owning pets. And there was a significant decrease in the amount of certain problems that are seen in the cost of treating those problems based on pet ownership. People had less costs associated with heart issues, less costs associated with weight problems, less costs associated with psychology issues such as anxiety, depression, PTSD. So for people that may not care about the animals, the effect that these animals have on their owners actually are a benefit to society in general, because it's helping the community stay safer and healthier.
Absolutely. So the fact that we aren't subsidizing or supporting financially pet ownership is a real problem, and it makes no sense. And there is money for this. Again, there are ways that we could support this. We just have to be innovative in the way that we think about it. Pets are family members. They are not optional. And I'm very passionate about this because I was in grad school when I was teaching at Indiana University. I was doing a PhD. I lived just above the poverty line, and my dog Kodiak tore his ACL. And that was a very, very expensive surgery. I had pet insurance, but it only covered about half the cost. And I had to borrow and basically get money from everyone I knew in my family. And to think that I might have had to relinquish him, he was my life. Kodiak was my absolute heart dog, and I would have died without him. My mental health, my physical health would have been catastrophically affected if I had had to give him up. And I was lucky that I had resources. But you cannot ask people to not have pets because they're going through financial hardship. And the pets are going to lose. It's a lose-lose situation, right? Nobody wins when pets and people are separated. Nobody wins. So we need to figure out ways to make it possible for almost any family who wants a pet to have a pet.
Yeah, something needs to be done because, you know, we have two issues at hand. We have the fact that going through veterinary school is very expensive. Going through technician school and being accredited is very expensive. So we have a career that comes with a lot of expense, and then the expenses of running a veterinary practice and the equipment that is involved and the medications and everything. Running a veterinary practice is expensive. So for a veterinarian to stay open and be able to pay their staff appropriately, costs have to be at a certain range. So that makes it hard for people to be able to afford the care for their pets. So, but then there are people that cannot afford those costs. So that's where we get into a lack of balance between what is and what there needs to be. We have to find a way to help veterinarians stay open, be able to afford the equipment, to afford the facility, to afford the practice, be able to practice good medicine. And then we have to be able to balance that with finding a way of helping people with taking care of their animals and affording these costs.
Right. And I think, again, one of the ways we can do this is we need the support of big corporations and insurance companies. And we need to, apparently, if I have this right, only 2 or 3% of the philanthropic dollar goes to animals. Animals are sort of is they're so important to us, but we put them last in so many ways. They are not prioritized. That is an opportunity for us to learn and grow as a society and really say, you know what? We need to find some really creative solutions here. Pets are dying in shelters. People have massive mental health issues. These things can be remedied with also a social and cultural shift in ideology. And again, the notion that if you can't afford an animal, you shouldn't have one is not helping animals. So if you care about animals, that's a very judgy and elitist idea. I would honestly rather see a dog with this person who is homeless, but they have not been separated, than an animal in a shelter who's about to be euthanized. Like, that is how severe this crisis is. I want people to understand that animals are dying en masse in our country every day, and I'm watching it, and my own compassion fatigue is through the roof. And I'm not even the ones on the ground in the trenches, like the people in the rescue organizations themselves. So the problem is dire, and the solutions are possible. We just really need to come together. And here's the great thing about the human-animal bond, something that I think is a tremendous, is that it's not politicized, and it's something we can all agree on in our very divisive society. I feel like if we prioritize and put the human-animal bond at the center of major social issues, we might actually be able to get somewhere, because it's something we can all agree on. Our love for animals, those of us who love them, obviously people who don't want animals are, they're not in this category, but it's something that we can all agree on, our love for our pets, right? That should be able to unite us, and it should be able to get us to be able to solve some massive social problems. We put that human-animal bond at the center and really focus on that.
We think about the fact that animals do not thrive when they're in shelters, right? So one of the issues that I have with people, for instance, people that want to have one litter or want to have their pets have a litter, or that they are against spaying a feral cat that is pregnant. So their point is, well, I will find good homes for these animals, because they think of the animals that are in shelters as they're already being taken care of. So these animals are not taken care of, so we need to find them homes. And they don't understand that being in a shelter is not necessarily a true safe place, right? And not because, and I'm not trying to dump on shelters, because shelters are doing the best that they can to take care of these animals. But the reality of it is that animals in shelters are at a higher risk of getting sick. Cats have higher rates of respiratory infections. Dogs have a higher rate of intestinal parasites and things that come from having to go to the bathroom in places that other animals are going. They're not going out as often as they would want to. They are not having the affection and connection with people that leads to good mental health. So people need to understand that every animal that they find a home for is taking a home away from an animal that is at a shelter. So letting your pets have litters is just irresponsible at so many levels.
It really is. And this notion that they need it for their health or something, or they need that experience, is also just fraught. It's not true. But you're absolutely right. The problem is, breeders, like for instance, again, in California, huskies are way overbred. And I wish the breeders who raise those puppies would understand that those puppies are going to be, often they are euthanized. And it's not a slam, it doesn't have to be a slam on shelter workers. It's just the truth. They're in a really difficult position where they may have three or four dogs to a kennel and they're fighting. There's nowhere for the animals to go. People won't foster. People won't step up. Rescues are drowning. They don't have enough financial support. They don't have enough, again, fosters. So having a litter right now is absolutely completely unnecessary. And even if you're in an area of the country where there are fewer animals, that's an opportunity for us to transport animals out of, you know, areas where they're overrun and bring them here. Your pets don't need to have babies. I promise you they will have meaningful lives without it. And everybody, you're right that everybody thinks, yeah, I'll find a good home, but will you find a home where they can, where the people will actually step up, or will those animals be relinquished in a year? Because so many animals are surrendered at about age one or two. Mm-hmm. So you may think, yeah, I found a good home, but for how long? You know, and I just, people like to talk about, you know, there are such thing as responsible breeders who only have two litters a year, but right now we don't need more. We do not need more of any kind of animal. Like, we don't, because they're dying. And it's so, people don't realize because they don't look, they just don't. And these dogs and cats to them are kind of abstract, like, oh, animals are dying, it's sad. It's not sad, it's an effing crisis. It's a tragedy, it's a nightmare. And these are perfectly beautiful, healthy, loving dogs. They're losing their lives because humans are selfish and apathetic and don't do their research and all of those things. And we can do better. Like, why are we doing this? It's not necessary. We can do better.
Right. It is really important because, again, I feel sad and heartbroken when I see stories about humane societies that are having to put animals down for space. And especially when they're having to put down young animals, puppies, kittens, and such. And again, they get bashed by society because why are you killing these animals? And society doesn't understand that they are the problem. They are having to euthanize these animals because we're not stepping up. We're not doing anything to solve the problem. All we're doing is kind of getting behind a keyboard and saying, you don't care. They are the ones that care. They are the ones that showed up. They're the ones that came into work and that are having to deal with all those problems. So we have to be more understanding of what shelters and humane groups and humane societies and shelter veterinarians and technicians are going through because of the irresponsibility of people in the society.
Yeah, and people won't even step up again to foster. So animals just need a temporary place to go. And then we would be able to transport them to a location where they'd have better chance of being adopted, and people won't even foster, you know. So until people want to make this a priority, a social priority, until we want to fund shelters and rescues meaningfully, instead of literally what happens is people on Facebook or other social media will pledge money to a rescue if they take a dog, right? And we usually only have like 2 or 3 days to raise enough money, and rescuing an animal costs a lot of money. They need to be vetted. A lot of them need, they have perfectly treatable illnesses or injuries, but they need vet care. All of this is expensive. And we only have like, you know, 2 days or three to quit, or sometimes even a day to raise money for an animal. We need to find them a foster. Nobody steps up. So they end up being euthanized for space when it really would be a solvable problem if we would just stop making too many animals, step up for the animals who are here, fund shelters and rescues, instead of, you know, it being like a charity thing where, oh my gosh, individuals, I pledged $3, I pledged 10, trying to save. It's a rescue right now is like emptying an ocean with a spoon. Every time you save one dog or cat, for every dog or cat you save, there are 10 who are euthanized.
Tell us about your podcast, what it's about, and how people can get information about it.
Yeah, sure. So I am the host of a podcast called The Capital PET Pedestal on the Human Animal Bond. It's on Apple and anywhere you listen to podcasts. I haven't produced an episode in about a year because I had some work changes, long story, but I'm hoping to get it back up and running. Also about to launch a podcast on pet loss with a colleague of mine through the Association of Pet Loss and Bereavement. because I know pet loss is such a difficult time in people's lives when they lose their animals, and I really just sort of want to help them through the process. So those, that's up and coming. It's in its very, very baby infancy right now.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Courtney, for being part of this episode. Thank you for the information that you have, and thank you for the work that you're doing with the Human Animal Bond and Education. And we'll definitely want to have you back when you have your podcast on pet loss so that we can talk about that very important topic.
And I'd love to have you as a guest as well. So thank you so much for having me. I appreciate all that you do.
Thank you. And for all our listeners, thank you for spending this time for us, and thank you for caring.